This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When a director's first feature film is nominated for the big award at the Oscars, Best Picture, that's always something to take note of. And that is certainly the case with the movie American Fiction, which is written and directed by Cord Jefferson. It was nominated for 4 other Oscars as well. Before making the film, Cord Jefferson had a real career as a TV writer, early on with Larry Wilmore's Nightly Show on Comedy Central, then working on The Good Place and Succession and many more. He began, though, as a journalist. He contributed to The Root, The New York Times Magazine, and particularly Gawker. And that's how he got to know The New Yorker staff writer, Jelani Cobb.
Cord Jefferson and I met almost 15 years ago when we were both part of a listserv for Black writers. And we've kept in touch over the years, encouraging each other's work and keeping tabs on what we were up to. In 2019, he was a writer for Watchmen, which was one of my all-time favorite television shows. And even though I've known him for many years, I've kept a much closer watch on what he's doing professionally and artistically since then. This year, his directorial debut, American Fiction, was released, and the film has garnered a great deal of attention and praise.
American Fiction is based on a novel called Erasure, which is about a writer who's none too successful, and his name is Thelonious Monk Ellison. He's beyond frustrated with the publishing world, so he churns out a really trashy novel under a pseudonym, a deliberately offensive book full of the stereotypes that are euphemistically described as urban. And that book becomes a literary sensation.
Yes, well, first of all, let me just say that all of us here at Thompson Watt are thrilled with My Pathology. It is about as perfect a book as I have seen in a long, long while. And Mr. Lee, is this based on your actual life?
Yeah, you think some bitch-ass college boy can come up with that shit?
No, I don't.
Jeffrey Wright plays the writer Monk Ellison, and here's Jelani Cobb talking with the director, Cord Jefferson.
You know, the interesting thing I thought about the Ellison family is that they are affluent, educated, well-educated, and, you know, distinguished, and at the same time, dysfunctional, troubled, not an ideal family. And, you know, they have problems, but none of which require a social worker.
Yeah, exactly.
They have a different strand of difficulty. And I thought that was really kind of well represented in the line where Monk says that, you know, his life is, to paraphrase, messed up, just not in the ways that people think. So you mentioned this being something that Black creatives deal with. You know, and Monk is a character who very much feels that he's been constrained and has really been told who he is, or at least who he is supposed to be, based on these presumptions of what and who Black people are. Is that something you've related to in your own creative journey?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this was when I, you know, it started when I was, you know, when I was a journalist. The one of the last pieces of journalism that I wrote was called The Racism Beat. And it was how I had reached this point in my journalistic career when it was like every week I was being asked to write about the latest, you know, Black person, unarmed Black person murdered by the police or, you know, a trigger-happy nervous neighbor or just sort of some other white person. Or I was asked to write about, you know, somebody saying something racist about President Obama. And it just felt like, you know, it felt like, well, it felt spiritually degrading, right? Just to sort of like to be writing about this misery and pain over and over. But more than that, it felt like, you know, what to write about Mike Brown that you didn't already write about Trayvon Martin, or what to write about Breonna Taylor that you didn't already write about Mike Brown, right? Like, you feel like you're just sort of like writing stuff that is A, you know, emotionally tough, but also you're sort of like writing stuff that seems like it's falling on deaf ears sometimes. That you're just like, is anybody even paying attention to what I'm saying? So when I got into film and television, it was incredibly exciting because it felt like finally, you know, we are not beholden to any realities of the world. We're not sort of, but we can write about Black people doing anything. We can write about Black people living in fantastical, you know, other realms, or you can write about Black people in space or in an underworld, like whatever you want to write about, you can write about, because we are not tasked with sort of like representing the realities of the world. But I was, you know, surprised to find, lo and behold, that it wasn't long before people were coming to me and saying, do you want to write a movie about an unarmed Black person being killed by the police? Do you want to write a movie about drug dealers? Do you want to write a movie about slaves? And it felt like, oh, even here, even in this sort of world of fiction and fantasy, there's still a rigid perspective as to what Black life looks like and to what Black stories are. Like
the primacy of suffering, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. And it's just like, and it's a specific kind of suffering. You know, to your point, when you talked about sort of the problems that the Ellisons have, the Ellisons are suffering. You know, there is tragedy in their lives, but it's just not the same rote suffering that sort of people expect. It's just like, well, wait a minute. Where's the conversation about food stamps, right? Or sort of like, where's the dangerous interaction with a police officer? It's kind of like all of these things that like we've come to expect are not there, but it doesn't mean that they're not suffering. It just means that it's a different kind of suffering, and that there's a diversity in sort of like their suffering, and just as there's a diversity in the humanity of Blackness. So I think that to me was it was something that I really could not, I guess I wasn't surprised by, but it was something that I felt like pained by. And so when I found this novel, you know, 3 months before I found Erasure, I got a note back on a script from an executive through an emissary, not from the executive, but I got a note back from an executive that said, we want you to make this character Blacker. And that was, you know, I said to the emissary, I said, I will indulge that note if whoever gave it to you will sit in front of me and tell me what it means to be Blacker. Mm-hmm. Tell me how to make the character Blacker, and I will have that conversation. And of course, that note went away because the person was terrified to have that conversation.
And invariably, I guess the idea of that was going to be more of particular types of suffering or deprivation.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think for me, and I've, you know, written, you know, a whole lot of those stories myself, it's never been simply telling that story. I think it's the idea of telling that story to the exclusion of telling other stories.
Exactly.
Which becomes the biggest, yeah.
Exactly. That to me, especially nowadays, I think that those stories are more important than ever. You know, I think that in a country that's actively trying to erase slavery as it was from children's textbooks, I think that it's very important to remind people over and over again that this happened and the reality of what it looked like. You know, Black history in America now includes slavery, and it includes being the president of the United States. And between those two poles, there are many, many other stories that have yet to be told.
Mm-hmm. You know, the 40 million variations on the theme.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, what drew you to this novel? And of all the kind of projects that you could have taken on, you know, what were the themes in Erasure that felt familiar to you?
Well, Erasure is this very interesting sort of juxtaposition of two stories, right? Which is, it is Monk, the protagonist. It's his professional life and sort of his professional ambition, which is simply to write the kind of novels that he's interested in writing, which many of which are contemporary adaptations of classical Greek literature and classical Greek theater. And you have him sort of focused on trying to write the work that he wants to write and being told that it's not black enough, essentially. And then that story is juxtaposed with what's going on in his personal life. But it's juxtaposed with this more complex view of black life. It's sort of like his mm-hmm. his life and his family are what he mm-hmm. wants to see in the world. So it's sort of like this, it's this two-handed story of like, here's the problem and here's a solution to the problem. And sort of mm-hmm. here's what we want to see in the same novel. And so to me, I was incredibly attracted to the professional themes and the satirical themes and what it about the limitations that the world puts on black creatives and black art and sort of the expectations that the world puts on black art. But also on top of that, I was really drawn to the family stuff. You know, my mother didn't have Alzheimer's, but my mother died of cancer 8 years ago. And like Monk in the book, I moved home to help take care of my mother as she suffered. I have two siblings, like Monk has two siblings in the novel. We have a push and pull relationship the way that the siblings in the novel did, where sometimes we're closer, sometimes we're farther apart. We have like the father in the book, we have a very overbearing father figure who was, mm-hmm. Who we, you know, we sort of lived underneath his sort of very, very high expectations. And sometimes I would say impossibly high expectations. And so the more that I read, it started to feel like the sort of Venn diagram of Monk's life and my life, all these overlaps to the point that it started to feel a little eerie as I read.
So why did you choose to call the film American Fiction as opposed to Erasure?
Because we were worried about what that people would confuse it with Erasure, that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie from the 90s. In the world of all the sort of reboots and remakes, we were like, well, we don't want anybody thinking like, oh yeah, I remember that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I don't want to see that. That was one of the reasons. The second reason was that Erasure is a great title, but I think that you need something that feels a little bit splashier and catchier for films. Unfortunately, I just think that more self-explanatory than I guess Erasure was. The two final titles, when it really came down to choose the two that I were sort of was most excited about were The Western Canon and mm-hmm. American Fiction. And everybody thought The Western Canon was a little too literary. It was too mm-hmm. sort of cutesy by half. And so American Fiction was the one idea that I came in and everybody kind of rallied around that one pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. So you have an astounding cast for this film, and it's kind of an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
You have in this cast Jeffrey Wright, Tracy Ellis Ross, Issa Rae, Sterling K. Brown, and the great Leslie Uggams, and, you know, just to name a few of the people.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about how that cast came together? I know that Jeffrey Wright was your first choice for Monk.
Yeah. Yeah. So I started reading the novel with Jeffrey's voice in my head. That's how early I started thinking of him for the character. And I thought that our luck was over. Once we got Jeffrey, I thought, well, we got our first choice, so everything else is going to be our sixth, seventh choice. And then I started, you know, we started getting word, like, actually, Issa Rae said yes. Sterling K. Brown said yes. Mm. Eric Alexander said yes. Everybody was very excited to work with Jeffrey. Jeffrey legitimized the movie in a very real way. It was no longer just a good script and a director who had never directed anything before. It was Jeffrey Wright's involved. And that was like caused people's ears to perk up a little bit.
Here you go.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute. Why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me. Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me. And he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
Right. Ned, you don't make the rules.
But then what they told me, you know, a lot of them was that it was the script and it was the characters. You know, John Ortiz, who's wonderful.
Who is amazing in the film.
He's wonderful as Arthur, who plays Monk's agent. He told me that he'd read the script, and then he called his agent. He said, wait a minute, what part do they want me to play? And his agent said, they want you to play Arthur, the book agent. And he was like, they want me to be the book agent? He said, you know, it was the first time that somebody had just come to me and said, like, we just want you to be a guy. We don't want you to talk anything about, it's nothing about being Puerto Rican. It's nothing about being sort of like raised in the projects in Brooklyn or whatever, or sort of like your tragic childhood. It's just like, yes, you're Puerto Rican, but you're just a guy. That's not coming up. We talk about it all the time. Black actors are just not utilized in the ways that they could be. And not black actors of color are not utilized in the ways that they should be. We talk about it every year. They're underrepresented. They're underutilized. They're asked to play the same sort of parts over and over and over again. I say to everybody, look at what happens when you give these characters real roles. Mm-hmm. Look at the kind of actors you can get for these parts.
The writer and director Cord Jefferson, who made the film American Fiction. He's talking with Jelani Cobb, and their conversation continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk. And together, we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we'll return now to a conversation with Cord Jefferson. He's the writer and director of American Fiction, which was just nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor for Jeffrey Wright, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Jefferson is speaking today with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
You know, you mentioned Erica Alexander, you know, who is an amazing actress. And, you know, there's a particular scene in the film where Monk realizes that she is reading a novel that he has anonymously written. And he has this really incredible reaction. And I wondered, you know, what you were thinking about as you directed that scene you know, how that came together, because it really is a kind of striking confrontation on multiple levels between Monk and Coraline, who is Erica Alexander's character.
Monk is a very pugnacious guy. From the very beginning of the movie, he's arguing with his students, his colleagues, his family. You know, this is a guy who steamrolls everybody in his life. He's arrogant. He's frustrated and he's angry because he's so frustrated and wounded. Because sort of up until that part in the film, Monk very frequently just gets away with yelling at people and being arrogant and rude. I knew in that scene I wanted somebody who could really stand up to him and sort of be formidable in the way that he's formidable. And Eric Alexander was one of the reasons why I wanted her for the role was because she is a formidable woman. She is, mm-hmm. She's age appropriate. She's not, you know, it's not, I didn't want to do the Hollywood thing where we're getting 20 women in their 20s and 30s for a guy in his 50s. She's somebody who has lived experience, who's smart, who's intelligent, and who can sort of serve as the other side of this argument too, which is that I didn't want it to be like respectability politics, pull up your pants movie, that sort of this is good black art and this is bad black art. And so I think that showing somebody in that scene also who is smart, who's accomplished, who's a lawyer, a professional person, the way that Monk is a professional person, who we understand has a good rapport with Monk, who likes this book that Monk hates, who sees value in this book that Monk hates, who sort of sees it as being art when Monk sees it as being garbage. I think that to give voice to that was incredibly important for the movie to not feel like it was scolding certain kinds of blackness or scolding certain kinds of black stories. Another scene that I think is incredibly important to the film and to that end is the scene where him and Santara sort of butt heads and discuss their sort of like different ideological opinions.
Yeah, Santara is the author of the novel that he that kind of sends him on this spiral in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it also sort of allows us to see what happens when Monk is sort of not honest with the people in his life and sort of how that facade and that dishonesty are sort of leading him on this dangerous path toward, you know, toward a life that his father led, which is one of constant lying and constant hiding, and ultimately, you know, a very, very tragic end.
So you mentioned tragic end. It's important to note in the course of this conversation that this film is a comedy. It's a satire.
Yeah.
And it is a tremendously funny one.
Thank you.
You know, one where, you know, I laughed, you know, throughout the movie. You know, the people in the audience at the screening where I saw, you know, laughed at it a lot. I had a really interesting conversation with a person who said that they laughed at it, who works in publishing, they laughed at it despite the fact that they thought they might have been the butt of the jokes themselves. So I'm curious about what goes into grappling with the weighty themes that we've been talking about, you know, for the past however long, and also presenting that in a way that makes people laugh.
Despite sort of like the tenor of things in the year 2023 and 2024, I think that race is actually really, really a fertile target for laughter. On the one hand, race is not real. You know, we've read enough there's enough scientists who've told us enough to understand that race is a social construct, that there is no, there's no basis for it in biology, and that we are kidding ourselves if we think that it's real at all. That being said, race is also incredibly real in that we've constructed our institutions and our societies believing that it is real. And so on the one hand, race is not real and insignificant and very real and incredibly important. Sometimes life or death depends on race. And so to me, that inherent tension and absurdity is perfect for comedy. I grew up in a household in which my dad played a lot of Richard Pryor vinyl. and I watched
Ditto.
Hollywood Shuffle over and over, and in which sort of we watched Eddie Murphy and sort of a lot of these like great Paul Mooney.
Earth to save itself. Have you noticed it's been fighting back with earthquakes and the rest of the stuff? It's fighting back. It don't need. Don't worry about that. Worry about people, each other. Can't worry about the animals or anything else. Something with four legs and got teeth. It'll be fine. And I blame it all on white people. I blame it on white people. I do. Because you guys started out messing this stuff up. Chopping down trees to build boats to go get black folks. And now that the picnic is over, you want us to help you recycle. I'm not recycling a damn thing.
These things in which people sort of approach these subjects with a comedic lens was just part of my upbringing. And I think that I sort of saw that as being a way to diminish the power that it had over all of us and to sort of mock it and sort of mock the idea of it, while also finding ways to laugh to keep from crying, right? You just have to underline that and point it out to people and have them laugh at it. That does sort of... It also invites a lot of people into the party.
You mentioned Hollywood Shuffle, and elsewhere you've referred to that film as a spiritual predecessor to American fiction. And, you know, it's a cult classic by Robert Townsend, and it deals with the subject matter of kind of stereotyping and, you know, how black actors have to grapple with that.
Only an Uncle Tom would do this shit. They just looking for somebody to sell out.
Sell out?
The only role they gonna let us do is a slave, a butler, or some street hood or something. Don't sell out, brother. Don't be a butler or a slave.
Jesse Wilson. Jesse Wilson, you're next.
That's me.
Good luck, brother.
Now, were there particular themes or even like scenes in American fiction that were inspired by, you know, what you took from Hollywood Shuffle?
I would say, I don't think necessarily scenes, but I think that one of the things that Hollywood Shuffle does so well is it never sacrifices commitment to character for comedy. Mm. And so what I mean by that is that it is a very, very funny movie. It's almost sort of like sketch comedy at certain points. Like that's how sort of like much it becomes a comedy film. It gives you a real perspective into his family and to his sort of like this emotional Sophie's choice that he's making between professional success and sort of personal dignity. Like there's all these commitments and efforts to make you understand that this is a real person that I really felt was important when I wanted to make my movie. For me, there was three pillars that sort of were maintaining the spirit of Erasure. The one was that it needed to be funny because the book is incredibly funny. The second is that it needed to be metatextual in some ways, like the book. I knew that was important to the novel. So I wanted the movie to feel a little meta. And then the third was that it couldn't be didactic. You know, the book takes great pains to never say this is right or this is wrong. I needed to make a movie that didn't spoon feed morality.
And of course, he was writing that book, Erasure, in response to a lot of what he saw going on in the fiction world and the same sorts of
absolutely
ideas. So it really is a kind of meta situation.
I'll tell you how meta it is that Percival, last week, Percival got stopped in a coffee shop by somebody who thought he was Jeffrey Wright. Yeah, incredible.
That's pretty amazing.
Cord Jefferson, the director of American Fiction, which is based on a novel by Percival Everett. The film was nominated for 5 Oscars. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the dean of Columbia Journalism School. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Right now, the Gaza Strip is the deadliest place in the world for journalists. At least 76 Palestinian journalists and media workers have been killed since Israel's air and ground campaign began. And there's a real question whether some have been targeted deliberately because of their work. That's very much up in the air. Israel has also jailed 19 journalists since the war began. The safety of the press is not just an issue in the Middle East, and it's not just an issue in wartime. Around the world, the old rules that respected the freedom of journalists to operate, at least in theory, you're seeing more and more those rules being simply ignored, even here in the United States. I spoke the other day with the CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Jody Ginsburg. She was formerly the Reuters Bureau Chief for the UK and Ireland. And I know Jody pretty well because, in the interest of transparency, I serve on the board of CPJ, and I care very deeply about this work. As long as I've been involved with CPJ, every year seems to be worse, particularly the last several years. What are the trends that are making it more and more dangerous to be a journalist?
What we've seen over the past few years is a decline in democracy and democratic norms and values worldwide, which means journalists are now at risk in places where traditionally they've been relatively safe. So, for example, we've seen here in the US, leaders including Donald Trump smear journalists as enemies of the people, fake news that unleashes online harassment, death threats, unfortunately physical violence that translates into physical violence in the real world. We've seen journalists harassed at protests worldwide, political rallies. And at the same time, we're also seeing authoritarian regimes become emboldened, so continuing to imprison journalists. And of course, we're seeing a world in which we have more and more complex, prolonged crises. So Afghanistan, Myanmar, Ukraine, and now, of course, Israel, Gaza, and all of that is coming together to make it a much more riskier profession than it ever has been.
Well, you know, wars have always been with us. Wars have always been perilous, but it does seem worse. And when we look at Gaza, which is a very particular place, hemmed in, what is happening there that gives you special concern? A recent number from CPJ gives us 83 journalists have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. Most of them are Palestinians, obviously, four are Israeli. That is more journalists killed in the past 100 days of war than have been killed in a single country over an entire year. What is going on in Gaza?
Gaza is unprecedented. Part of that is to do with the size of Gaza, the density, the fact that there is nowhere to go that's safe. In wars that you talk about, of course, covering war is perilous, but frequently people choose to go to cover war. In this case, all of the journalists covering the war are Gazan journalists. Those inside Gaza are Gazan journalists, and they have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to escape. And the things that they are covering, there's no way to do so safely. You can't cover the aftermath of an attack and go to a hospital in the knowledge that the hospital will be safe because hospitals have attacked. You can't go to a refugee camp to cover the displacement of 85% of the population because refugee camps have been attacked. So there's nowhere to operate safely. And that's part of the reason why we've seen this high level of killings of journalists in this very short space of time.
We should also say that in Gaza, with very rare exceptions, CNN, for example, of course, the Ward was one exception, people from outside of Gaza who want to cover the war, in other words, coming in from Israel or Egypt, but particularly Israel, can only go in through embedded forays with the Israel Defense Forces, with the army, with the Israeli army. How does that affect things?
As you say, only a very small number of journalists have been able to go in on entirely controlled Israeli military visits. That has two effects. One is it increases the pressure on local journalists. Local journalists who, remember, are suffering the same things that ordinary citizens and civilians are suffering. They're suffering from a lack of food. They're suffering from a lack of shelter. They're suffering from a lack of power. It also puts the burden on them to be the eyes and ears for the rest of the world as to what's happening.
Right. Just to be clear, I took a couple of trips recently to the Middle East, and what you were seeing on television was highly circumscribed. You saw Gaza mainly as a matter of military operations. You did not see, certainly not very often, suffering Gazans. Dead babies, dead people, destroyed homes. That was something you went elsewhere to see. I guess the biggest question here is whether these Palestinian journalists are being targeted. In a recent article, CPJ expressed concern, and this is very carefully worded, I think, expressed concern about the, quote, apparent pattern of targeting journalists and their families by the Israeli military. What do we know and what do we not know?
If I may, I'd take a step back first before we talk about what's happened since October the 7th. So in May last year, the Committee to Protect Journalists published a report called Deadly Pattern, which looked at the pattern of killings by the Israeli military of journalists over the preceding 22 years. And we found that 20 journalists had been killed, 18 of them Palestinians. Not one single case has anyone been held accountable. So that was a pattern that we were already seeing prior to this war. Since October the 7th, we've seen a number of cases in which journalists have been killed when clearly wearing press insignia. For example, the Reuters journalist Issam Abdallah, who was killed on the Lebanese border, operating from an area known to be somewhere where journalists frequently film from, clearly with a group of other journalists. We've seen that in the case of Hamza Dakhtour, the son of the Al Jazeera Gaza City bureau chief, Wael Dakhtour, who was targeted in a drone strike. Israel has admitted that they targeted that car, but have accused the two journalists who were killed of being terrorists. And evidence they've produced, again, as we saw in previous years, extremely flimsy, very questionable. Many of the journalists who've been killed have been killed in airstrikes, and it's difficult to know at this point in time, when we're still in the middle of a war, whether that happens to be that dreadful phrase, collateral damage. People are reporting at places where it's extremely dangerous to report from. But there have been cases where journalists have also been killed in their homes, or their homes have been attacked after they've received warnings to stop reporting or to leave. And those are the cases where it's still unclear whether they were deliberately targeted for being journalists or they happened to be in a place that was under bombardment. And those are things that we are looking into to try to understand.
What's your access to the evidence?
It's limited, and increasingly limited, because the more the bombing goes on, the less you have evidence. No one can get into Gaza to do these investigations, so we're talking as much as we can to local journalists. We spoke recently to a journalist who was close by when Hamza Dakhtour's car was attacked, but it's extremely difficult, and of course, the longer the war goes on, the harder it becomes.
Does CPJ confront Israeli officials with these cases?
We ask for comment. We very rarely get any
response. Who do you appeal
response.
To?
We appeal to the army authorities.
And?
We get very little back. And So the case that spurred us to do the Deadly Pattern report was the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, mm-hmm. who was the voice of Arab media, of Palestine for many people. So she was an Al Jazeera correspondent. She was shot and killed in May 2022 by Israel. Initially, again,
well, shot by Israel. Who, shot by whom and where?
So she was shot by an Israeli soldier. Initially, Israel said, "Well, perhaps she was shot by Palestinian fire." There was no Palestinian fire. It became clear that she was shot by Israeli soldier. They claimed that it wasn't a targeting. Yet she was shot when she was very clearly visible as a journalist. Again, in her press insignia. She was wearing a helmet, she had a press flak jacket on, a bulletproof vest, and she was shot between the helmet and the press vest, so in the neck. She was such a well-known, well-loved, well-respected figure in the region, and the death was incredibly shocking. And we've still seen no investigation into the killing and no one held accountable, despite the fact, by the way, that she's also an American citizen. She was not just a Palestinian citizen, she was an American citizen, and we're still waiting for a more detailed outcome of the investigation into her.
Was there any interest from the State Department?
There was interest from the State Department, and I met Antony Blinken last year to talk about the killings in Gaza, and the State Department continues to stress how important it views press freedom and how concerned it is by the killings of journalists, and yet...
Did you feel that you were being fobbed off with cliches about how important press freedom is?
I feel... Blinken is a former journalist, right? Mm-hmm. I feel he is sincere. I feel the State Department and USAID, Samantha Power, also a former journalist, I feel they are sincere, but their actions do not meet their words. Well, we hear a lot about how important the president... The State Department thinks press freedom is, and yet we continue to see these high numbers of deaths. You will have seen that the deaths of journalists were specifically mentioned in South Africa's submission to the ICJ in its accusations of genocide against Israel. So we do expect some...
Do you take a stand on that case, the South African accusation of genocide against Israel?
We don't take a stand on those more... what you might call macro cases. Our focus is on journalists and justice for journalists and making sure journalists can be protected and are protected. And one of the things that we have really focused on in the past 3 months is the documentation, having the evidence. You know, I'm a journalist. You're a journalist. I became a journalist because I think information is the most powerful tool we have for achieving justice. And so one of our key roles is to be the people documenting what's happening. And it might not change things immediately, but hopefully that can provide some of the information that will help to achieve justice in the long run.
Jody, you and I are creatures of what Sarah Palin so charitably called the lamestream media, the mainstream media. You worked at Reuters for a long time. Things have changed. And in many ways, the influence of TikTok dwarfs some of the mainstream media outlets that we've, you know, grown up criticizing but respecting.
I think it's easy to think of journalism as being, with no offense, the New Yorker, the New York Times, the Washington Post. The vast majority of the journalists that we work with are local journalists doing really important, impactful work that impacts their local communities. You think about places like Mexico, the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist outside of a war zone. Those journalists are doing incredible work trying to expose the nexus between government corruption and organized crime and paying the ultimate price for it. And with very little protection, without the kind of name recognition that you would have if you were a well-known CNN reporter or a BBC reporter. If we as CPJ can keep reminding people, that's why it's valuable, that's why it's important, that's why we defend it. I don't defend journalists because I think we're some sort of special...
Some sort of special
species. Right. I defend it because I genuinely believe that by getting to the truth and the facts, we can make the world a better place and we can do things and make changes that have direct positive impact on our lives as individuals.
Now, many of our listeners will have heard about, and we've talked about this on the program before, the reporter Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal. Putin has kept Evan in jail on bogus espionage charges for the better part of a year now. Speaking as an editor who assigns reporters around the world, it's a very dicey thing sending somebody to Russia right now, even if they have all the proper accreditation. You take a lot into your hands doing that.
But that's intentional. That's intentional because what editor wants to have the responsibility of sending someone abroad, someone to Russia, in the knowledge that they may well be jailed? The thing about Evan's detention is because it felt unexpected, because foreign journalists had been able to operate somewhat freely, as you say, it felt almost like, you know, Russia was trying something out to see whether it would work. And actually, the Committee to Protect Journalists does a census every year of journalists who've been arrested who are in jail on December the 1st every year. And Russia has the majority of foreign journalists who are detained. The challenge that the US and others have is what levers do you have?
Yeah.
You know, in the case of Evan Gershkovich, there was much talk about prisoner swap. We can't be reliant entirely on having someone that Russia or somewhere else wants to swap with in order to be able to assert the importance of press freedom worldwide.
No, that's not because a good economy.
Well, you know, it sort of encourages international state-sponsored hostage taking.
What are your, you know, we've been through this experience once, and everybody has noted about not just the name calling, but the bullying and the rhetoric and all the rest. What do you fear in a second Trump presidency? I see all the color rushing out of your face.
I fear that the gloves come off. Trump supporters have already said, we heard, I think, Steve Bannon on one radio show talking about the fact that they would come for the media in a second term. And in a country that has the highest gun ownership in the world, that worries me. I know of journalists who now take off the foam part of their microphones, which indicate the news outlet that they might be from, because they don't want to be targeted. Death threats have become the daily experience of pretty much political reporters everywhere. And I don't just mean those people who report on the White House. That includes people working for local newspapers in Texas and elsewhere, enabled by this narrative from the top, but also, frankly, from individuals like Elon Musk. As we saw in Las Vegas last year, a young female journalist was reporting on the hit and run of a police chief. Social media kind of misrepresented and misunderstood the coverage. There was a pylon and Musk came in and escalated it to the point where she felt so threatened she had to move. And this, by the way, was a reporter who worked for a newspaper where the year before, a journalist who received threats online was killed at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. So I think there's a lasting legacy of that. And certainly there's a lasting legacy in which those in positions of authority feel empowered to clamp down on journalists. We've seen that in some of the legislation proposed in Florida for weakening defamation laws. We've seen that in the behavior of some police authorities in various parts of the United States. So I think it has, if you like, created a new low bar.
What would you like to see happen from either the mouth of the President of the United States or anyone else with political or moral influence in this country? There's a limited amount that CPJ can do from day to day, alas. What would you want Joe Biden, or pick your influencer in the broadest sense, to get up and say, and would it matter?
The one thing that I always found impressive about American media was that you would come out in support of one another. Everyone's fiercely competitive, and yet at the same time, news outlets tended to be supportive of one another's right to report, and whenever that seemed to be restricted, would come out very publicly in support of one another. That's not always the case elsewhere. That's not the case in UK. It's not in the case, certainly in places like Turkey and Poland. And I would not want the divisiveness that we have seen in the political landscape and somewhat in the media to result in a situation in which news outlets fail to defend one another's right to report, because that would be really dangerous. We were slow to, as journalists, to recognize the threats against us and to talk about them. And yet, internationally, we know that when democracies decline, the first people to be attacked are journalists and the media. Among the, you know, it's a leading indicator of democratic decline. And unfortunately, we're on a trajectory in which democracies are imploding, which means that we're going to see more journalists under threat, more journalists needing support, more journalists needing our help than ever before. And we can play a powerful role in helping those journalists and highlighting their importance.
Sometimes it's because governments are shamed. And if you have the capacity for shame, it means you have, at least in some corner of your soul or political being, a conscience. That seems to be in rarer supply.
Shame is less of a stick than it used to be. It used to be the case that governments and nonprofits like CPJ could publish a story about the poor behavior of a government, and particularly if that government wanted to be seen publicly as respectable or was trying to gain respect, it might put its hands up and say, we made a mistake, and release the journalist in question or prosecute someone. That's not the case anymore. So we have to find new avenues. There is a link, of course, between information and the economy. If China kicks out every single journalist and every single reporter, how do those people investing in China know what's happening? Hong Kong is a very good case in point. Mm-hmm. So Hong Kong, which is currently holding the media entrepreneur Jimmy Lai, has always prided itself on its ability to attract investment and, you know, holds itself up in opposition almost to Singapore. And now has rapidly fallen down in press freedom indices and democracy indices. And that inevitably at some point will have a knock-on effect of people's willingness to invest and trade there. So I think we have to find new tools other than the name and shame.
Money walks is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Jody Ginsburg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jody Ginsburg is the president of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and I'm on the board of CPJ. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me this hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.